KVS. Today is Tuesday, March 16th, 2010, and you're listening to KVOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KVOO.fm on the web. And this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Governors Ted Kulongoski and Christine Gregoire are off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Wind.
Meanwhile, downstate in Coos Bay, the town is planning to ban wind power.
And it's the 7th anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie, bulldozed by Israeli Defense Forces as she stood protecting the Palestinian home. Oh, the bitter irony. As more settlements are being planned right now, even as we speak, in East Jerusalem.
Portland area weather today and tomorrow, a chance of showers, highs around 60. Low tonight around 42, and then beginning Thursday, sunshine, with highs in the low 60s and lows in the mid-30s.
And first news from around Cascadia. The city of Coos Bay is planning on passing a resolution to ban wind energy in the city limits. The meeting is today. It would mean that agencies like Community Action, Coos Bay Public Schools, and companies like Walmart will not be allowed to utilize rooftop wind turbines to develop mini microgrids on their buildings. Joining us today to talk about it is Jody McCaffrey, one of the major anti-LNG activists in the area. Good morning, Jody. Thanks for joining us again on Air Cascadia.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, this is an irony, isn't it? We're always being told that environmental concerns and issues aren't good for jobs. What's going on here in Coos Bay?
Well, they are worried about having people put small wind up because it might be noisy or unsightly. So rather than do their homework first, they've decided to just ban wind in the city limits. Are they going to have this resolution tonight where they decide this at their city council meeting? And then maybe at some later date, you know, they may, you know, lift this moratorium. But as far as it, when you read the resolution, it pretty much is a ban on anybody doing wind turbines, which means some of the projects that I've been working on with other groups here will be stopped.
How do they reconcile that, this ban on wind power, with the prospect of introducing liquefied natural gas terminals on the Oregon coast?
Yes, they basically have no concern of that. They didn't, when we have gone to the council about that, and here you're going to have these LNG tankers coming in. If there was a problem, a huge portion of their people would be harmed or killed, and yet there's no concern of them for that. It's just, you're talking, it's almost like, unbelievable.
I've rarely seen or heard of a wind turbine exploding and creating a 3-mile blast zone.
Yes.
What about the job issue?
Well, this is the whole thing. I'm on a team, it's called Oregon Solutions, and we have a Coos County chapter that I'm working with a county commissioner and several other members of our community. We're working actually with 5 counties on trying to work together to bring in, you know, some of this money so that we can develop in Southern Oregon renewable energy projects. So this is almost like us, you know, going against what we've been trying to do to create jobs. It's very frustrating, but obviously it's not the, you know, they want to blame environmentalists and regulations why we don't have jobs in our area. Well, that obviously isn't the case.
So Ellen, the way they're seeing it is that jobs created by this LNG project are jobs, but jobs created by wind turbines aren't jobs.
Well, they're trying to say, oh, no, we don't have any rules and regulations for wind. You know, that's their whole thinking. And we need to develop this before we let people put a wind turbine up. So, I mean, I can understand that to some point, but I can't understand just banning wind, because there's not, who around here is even doing wind that can afford to do it? It's only our project. That's the only thing I know. So
when's the meeting?
It's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Coos Bay City Council Chamber, and that's at 500 Central Avenue in Coos Bay.
So anyone who is listening online or lives down that way or feels like taking a scenic drive to the coast, there's an opportunity. Thanks so much for that. My guest has been Jody McCaffrey, notable Coos Bay anti-LNG activist. Thanks a lot, Jody.
Thanks.
The bipartisan Governor's Wind Energy Coalition wants the federal government to do a better job of promoting wind energy, such as, well, requiring the utilities to produce at least 10% of their energy from renewable sources by 2012 would be something. The coalition represents governors of 29 states. Today it plans to hand the recommendations off to Congress and the White House. Offshore wind development and new infrastructure for electric transmission are also included in the wish list. Governor Kulongoski and Washington Governor Gregoire are members of the group.
I guess they haven't heard what's going on in Coosa. Here in Portland, though, Police Chief Rosie Sizer will be out of town this Thursday when a Portland City Council session on a resolution to strengthen police oversight is being held. Portland Commissioner Randy Leonard says it's time to put some teeth in the city's independent oversight division, something that Portland Cop Watch and everyone else has been saying for years now. Sizer wanted the council to wait until she returns on March 20th from a law enforcement-related trip. Commissioners Amanda Fritz and Nick Fish want further input at an evening hearing in April to give Police Chief Rosie Sizer time to attend. And they also want time to consider any proposed amendments to what would be the first major reforms to the police oversight division. And Aaron Campbell probably wished that the cop who shot him in the back had waited before pulling the trigger.
In case you missed it, last night, Oregon's two Democratic contenders for governor aired the nuances separating their platforms like Navi zooming between floating mountains. In a debate sponsored by the Multnomah County Democrats, John Kitzhaber and Bill Bradbury agreed on the need for budget reform, jobs growth, and support of public education. But then who doesn't? Kitzhaber advocates massive reform of public education by creating a single budget system for preschool to post-secondary education. Bradbury says money is most important. He wants to find $2 billion to put into public education immediately. Bradbury also called for the creation of a Bank of Oregon to invest in small and mid-sized business development.
Fishing's a rough business, but navigating the fish export maze is a challenge on a whole other level. An obscure European tariff designed to protect a Scandinavian fishing industry that no longer exists is costing the West Coast about 1,000 jobs. This comes as the Obama administration aims to double U.S. exports within 5 years. Oregon exporters will be swimming against the European Union's 20% duty on cooked peeled shrimp, shipping container shortages, tight credit, border delays, inconsistent regulations, trade promotion glitches, and travel visa problems. So fish need visas? Dead fish? Later this month, Oregon export companies will meet with President Obama's top export official to seek ways to reduce international trade barriers and their general aura of confusion.
The Crystal Ballroom, flagship of the McMenamins fleet, caught one midships from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, notable for its humorless approach to fun in Portland. The Crystal has the no-brainer choice of paying a fine of $5,280 or serving a 32-day license suspension. Four restrictions will be placed on the establishment's liquor license for two violations under sanctions imposed yesterday by the redoubtable OLCC. The commission says it all comes after more than 2 years of problems and incidents at the dance hall on West Burnside.
How far is it from Portland to Rawalpindi? Not that far if we use dollars to measure the distance. A lot of money flows into Pakistan, and it does so with our silent consent. What we should be asking is what exactly that money is up to. What are U.S. dollars doing over there? Because it doesn't look like they've made life better for the average Pakistani. My guest this morning is familiar with the nuances of the question. M.J. Chohan, advisory board member with the Islamic Society of Greater Portland, welcome to Air Cascadia.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me over.
Thank you so much for joining us on short notice. A lot of money is flowing from the United States into Pakistan, and all so far we've really seen are really, really angry people. There's been another drone strike, a U.S. missile strike. There's been clashes between extremist gunmen and tribesmen, killed at least 20 militants today. This would be up near the Pakistan-Afghan border in Waziristan. Can you talk a little bit about why Pakistanis are unhappy with American foreign policy as it's expressed in monetary terms?
Well, when it comes to the monetary terms, and the Pakistani reactions to the, this is all based upon the, how the government of Pakistan, from the last 10 years and plus, has been portraying the problem in Pakistan. Whereas my understanding, humble understanding, is that the money which we, which is flowing from U.S. to Pakistan is not appropriately given to the task where we intended to send this money to. So the government in Pakistan for the last 10 plus years has been abusing that money and not using to stop the Talibanization or extremism in Pakistan. Instead, they're playing a double role. They're fooling the people in Pakistan and also trying to fool the people in Washington to get more money.
And that money has done virtually no good. The issue of drones, too, the missile strikes fired by unmanned predator-type aircraft has really enraged people. What do you feel that there is a gap in Americans' understanding of people in places like Waziristan? This is a very remote area. We send these things flying over. We don't know the people, the clans, the language. We don't know anything at all about the people there. Can you talk about that a bit?
Obviously, I mean, the people, the government of Pakistan has been very ignorant about the culture and the customs of the people of Northwest. Within the country, of course, you can see that the people, those have been considered the Pakistani territories, or used to be called the free zones. But the government of Islamabad never had the control on those territories for the last 60-plus years.
They're very remote, they're very independent, and in some places in that area, it would be news to people that they were part of a country called Pakistan. And yet we're going in there, guns a-blazing, and that's more money down the rat hole, accomplishing virtually nothing except alienating people. This is all, the first they've ever heard of America is when their village blows up.
It's a fact of life there. The only fear, definitely, we have that maybe some Taliban running from Afghanistan side coming and sheltering themselves in those territories, those were totally unknown to the people of Pakistan.
Because it's so remote, because it's an ideal hiding place, that would naturally be where someone would go to hide. So the people living in these places are victims of American largesse when it comes to the aid that's being poured into Pakistan. Can you, just in closing, do you see any light at the end of the tunnel? Do you see any resolution to the problem?
In my humble opinion, if the government of Pakistan is sincere to eliminate the extremism, then we can find and see the light at the end of the tunnel. If they have sincere efforts to remove that fundamental element, whether that's coming from Afghanistan or they are within those territories, if they are wholeheartedly willing to eliminate, there are so many means and ways we can use those and stop it.
Thank you so much for that. My guest today has been M.J. Chan, who is on the advisory board with the Islamic Society of Greater Portland. We've just barely begun to touch on this topic, and we'd like to talk more about it. Anybody who here in Portland, in our listening area, who thinks that this is a remote issue and nothing to do with us, could not possibly be more wrong. The distance, as we said at the beginning of the interview, between Pakistan and Portland is not much in terms of American money. Thanks again very much, Mr. Chan, for your words today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Today's the 7th anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie in Gaza by Israeli government bulldozer. The bitter irony is that the anniversary this year comes at an unusually bad time in U.S.-Israel relations, which is actually a rare flash of light in U.S.-Israel relations. The U.S. appears to be putting some real effort into establishing narrower boundaries for Israel's behavior toward its Palestinians. Nonetheless, Rachel did not die for nothing, and she will not be forgotten. This break in U.S.-Israeli relations is part of her legacy. This has been Eric Cascadia for Friday, March 12, 2010.
Excuse me, Tuesday, March 16th.
Engineering is Janet Anderson. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. Chris Andre is the producer. I'm Liam Delta.
You're listening to News and Comment from Eric Cascadia on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, KBOO.fm on the web. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thanks so much, members.
Coming up next, Flashpoints. The first corporation candidate, an interview with Rachel Corrie's father, and the aftermath of the Iraqi elections.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support. And have a good day.
On Flashpoints, the first corporate campaign for Congress. We'll also begin our daily coverage of the lawsuit being brought by the parents of Rachel Corrie against the State of Israel for wrongful death, and we'll feature an update on the elections in Iraq. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. On Saturday, the Washington Post published a front-page story about the corporation Murray Hill running for Congress. Quote, after the Supreme Court declared that the corporations have the same rights as individuals when it comes to funding political campaigns, the self-described progressive firm took what it considers the next logical step, declaring for office. William Klein, a hired gun who has been enlisted as Murray Hill's campaign manager, said the firm appears to be the first corporate person to run for office and is promising a spirited campaign that puts people second or even third. Mr. William Klein joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, sir, to Flashpoints.
Nice to be with you, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. The first corporation, obviously this campaign is inspired and powered by the decision of the Supreme Court to give corporations the same rights as citizens.
That's right. We feel that the decision by the enlightened majority of the Supreme Court allows us to take the next step. They have declared us, codified our status as corporate persons with all the rights that individuals should have, and we feel that running for office is the logical next step.
Okay. Let's follow this down the road a little bit. So Murray Hill is running in the 8th District of Maryland, Tacoma, I guess that is Tacoma, Maryland. Who's your opposition?
Yes, it's Montgomery County, Maryland, which is a large county with close to 1 million residents, and the district isn't the entire county, but much of it. It's Bethesda, Silver Spring, Tacoma Park. The incumbent is a Democrat named Chris Van Hollen, who gets in the news every once in a while, but we are running in the Republican primary, or I should say we hope to run in the Republican primary, because we feel that the Republican Party is our natural home.
Okay, now, after all, this is a corporation that's running for office, so I understand you have to have somebody who's a stand-in. Who would that be?
Yes, well, the shareholders of Murray Hill, Inc. voted to make Mr. Eric Hensel the campaign-designated human. You know, we do have to conform to antiquated election laws and policy and customs, so where necessary, where a human signature is required or some human interface, Mr. Hensel is our designated human, and he is performing those responsibilities.
Now, what do you and Murray Hill hope to gain? What would any corporation hope to gain in this kind of a campaign, and if you win?
Well, I would think the answer to that is obvious. We're looking for power and wealth. But we see this as the court has opened up the opportunity for us to get in on the emerging market of corporate democracy. And so we do hope to corner the market in corporate elections before the whole thing is bought by China. But secondarily, we do feel that the Supreme Court decision isn't really understandable in the abstract sense, when it just makes a ruling and it's reported on or is in the law journals. Most people in the country can't really grasp the full ramifications of it. So we're running our campaign to show people what the full extent of this ruling might be, and we feel that by putting it in the context of a real campaign, the hurly-burly of an election contest, that it's much more understandable to the American people.
Now, let me let people know, we're talking here with Mr. William Klein. He has been, what's a hired gun? Why do they call
him? Well, I'm not an officer or an employee of Murray Hill, Inc. I am a mercenary. I'm hired to get the job done and move on to the next challenge. So that's what the technical definition of the hired gun term.
Now, tell us a little bit about Murray Hill and what inspired them to be first. What do you believe is at the core of the campaign that you represent?
Well, we do see this as an important civil rights struggle. The next frontier in civil rights, that corporations are people too, and we are trying to pave the way for other corporations to follow our example. You know, we're saying to Walmart, AIG, and Pfizer, if not you, who? If not now, when? And we hope by being the first and by showing how it's done that some of other corporations will follow our example. In fact, we have just recently started to offer franchise opportunities to other corporations around the country to franchise our brand and to run on their own. But we are running on the issues that matter of unlimited corporate wealth and unchecked corporate power, and we feel that's an issue that is readily embraced by the voters of the 8th District.
Well, I'm wondering if you ever considered the notion of, sort of like a third-party candidacy, the Democrats, the Republicans, and the corporations.
Well, yes, it may come to that. You know, there have been times in our history when elected officials have been nicknamed things like this. I mean, back in the 1970s, Senator Henry Jackson from Washington was often called the Senator from Boeing, and senators from North Carolina have been called the Senator from R.J. Reynolds. But, we do hope, that was a nickname, an abstraction. We do hope to make it real by hopefully someday real corporations will be the dominant force in elected politics. But we have applied for voter registration in the Republican Party in Montgomery County, and just recently the Board of Elections rejected our application on the grounds that we were not a human being, in their words. We are going to be challenging that in court to fight for our legal rights.
Well, didn't the Supreme Court already decide that, in fact?
They decided based on contributions, but part of our struggle is to secure the voting rights that we feel we're entitled to. It may be that we do have to run an independent candidacy, but we don't have to declare in this election the voter registration, the application to run runs until the summer. So we're going to pursue our effort to run in the primary for a good while longer. But if it comes to that, we are prepared to run an independent candidacy.
Now, if you're a designated human that needs to vote or make a speech, who helps him make up his mind? How does he vote? Is there a new process?
Well, in terms of campaign speeches, there's going to be very little of that. We're running as human-free a campaign as possible. We're going to be relying on automated robocalls, social networking, and computer-generated avatars for our campaigning. Once we get elected, the designated human will have to conform to tradition where necessary, and he is authorized by the corporation to represent it, and there have been some appearances where Mr. Hensel has spoken in person, but he's made it very clear that he represents the corporation. He is not speaking as an individual or as we call it, a body human.
Now, and of course, this has to be cynical. In your statement, you say that this is the first campaign, and we're going to make sure we try and put the corporate person, put the promising a spirited campaign that puts people second or even third. What do you mean puts people second or third? We're already a little bit worried about too much corporate power.
Well, we hope that by the end of this campaign that some of those worries will be assuaged, and you'll find the benevolence and wisdom of corporate America more comforting. By putting people second or even third, I'm referring to what I just mentioned, that we will, the human interface in this campaign will be negligible, if not non-existent. So we do think that the corporate voice needs to be amplified and should be able to carry the day on its own.
Well, I'm not sure that Ralph Nader is going to get behind your campaign.
Well, you mentioned the novelist Ralph Nader. He once prophesied that we have an America of the General Motors, by the Fords, and of the DuPonts, or something like that. And I think that that prophecy has now finally come to pass.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. William Klein is a hired gun hired by Murray Hill. That's what is Murray Hill? It's a sort of a...
It's like a communications and a message strategy firm. And you can follow the campaign at Murray Hill, Inc. For Congress.com or see our video on YouTube.
All right. Well, it's been an honor having been a part of the first corporate campaign for Congress. Check it out. Follow it. We'll see what happens if you win. Take care now.
Thank you very much.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Trying to make a point there, I guess, with a little bit of humor. This is serious. We're going to do more reporting on corporate power in the age of a Supreme Court that believes corporations are humans. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm going to turn our attention back to the Middle East, and we're going to start with an interview we did with the father of Rachel Corrie at the trial now. They're suing the state of Israel for wrongful death. Listen to this. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Today marked the third day of testimony in the civil lawsuit filed by Rachel Corrie's family against the state of Israel for her unlawful killing in Rafah, Gaza. Rachel was crushed to death on March 16, 2003 by a Caterpillar bulldozer. She had been nonviolently demonstrating against Palestinian home demolitions. There is an abundance of evidence and eyewitness testimony that the bulldozer driver saw Rachel Corrie easily in her bright orange vest and ran over her to make an example of the brave young anti-occupation activist. Today on Flashpoints, we will commence with regular coverage of the trial taking place in Haifa, Israel. Joining us from Haifa is Craig Corrie. He is the father of Rachel, and he's been sitting in there at the trial that is a part of his lawsuit and the family's lawsuit. Craig Corrie, it's good to have you back with us on Flashpoints.
Oh, thank you, Dennis. It's great to be here.
Well, this is a very important story. It's a tragic story. And it's a story, one cell of a larger story that helps us understand the nature of repression and what's continuing to happen in illegally occupied Palestine. Today at the trial in Haifa, the only testimony came from, I guess it was a British citizen, a nurse, Alice Coy, who was an eyewitness to what happened. Could you tell us... Craig, what it was like to sit there and what she said.
Well, it's good to hear from each of the three eyewitnesses that we've had on and finally get in into a court where at least people are sworn to tell the truth, and these people certainly did. what happened. So it's no longer out on the internet, and we're there. Actually, after 7 years, and it's been 5 years since we filed the suit, in some ways it's a little anticlimactic. It feels like, and I think it really is, now just one more step. So we move forward. As you know, we've been trying to find some sort of resolution, more information about what happened to Rachel, and we tried to do that mostly through diplomatic channels or have a U.S.-led investigation, because what we're looking for, I think, is truth and some information, accountability on the part of Israel, and actually a civil lawsuit is one of the poorest ways to do that I know, but it's our remaining remedy, and we will take that step. So many Palestinians cannot. They just don't have the opportunity to do that. And I think with our opportunity comes the obligation to pursue whatever means we can for accountability.
Well, I think it would help. This is our first day of coverage on the trial. Why don't you give us your best shot at a thumbnail sketch of what might be most compelling to people who haven't followed it closely, but who want to know if this was a murder, and if this was a murder by the State of Israel?
Well, we probably haven't got to the best witnesses for that, because it's a strange process here. So affidavits are given by the eyewitnesses, and then they aren't really, that isn't discussed by our attorney. So the first attorney that talks to the witnesses in court is the, in this case, the respondent, and they're cross-examined rather than in a direct. So the military is that they're being defended by the state attorneys, that their attorneys spent almost all the time talking about the international solidarity movement and no time. They really would not talk about home demolition. So if you're just sitting in court, it's pretty hard to realize that the home that Rachel stood in front of was in danger of being demolished. The lawyers kept bringing up that, in their opinion, and the military said that they're simply clearing land there. And there's been no admission, for instance, that the home finally was destroyed. It's upsetting to hear them talk about all the time about terrorists. You know, this blanket statement, and frankly, I don't know what a terrorist is. I know under U.S. law that sort of the definition is terrorist act is an act that is part of an attempt to coerce, intimidate, or retaliate against a foreign government or civilian population. And, of course, by that definition, almost any modern army does terrorist act. So it's disturbing to me to hear that big lump of everybody together. And, of course, there's no admission, for instance, that the Nisrallah family, members of that family, came to the United States 2 years after Rachel was killed. I believe they were on KPFA. And, of course, to come to the United States, this was after the home was finally destroyed. They had to get a pass from the Israeli military to go to Tel Aviv, and in Tel Aviv apply from the U.S. Embassy for a visa to come to the United States. So even after Israel destroyed this family's home, Israel and the United States had nothing against this family. They're far from terrorists. So those sorts of things are frustrating. There's also been, there was testimony from the Israeli pathologist, Professor Hiss, from the National Forensic Institute that did the pathological examination of Rachel, did the autopsy. And I really can't go into details on that because I'll testify about that later, but you can go to the Rachel Corrie Foundation for Peace and Justice, rachelcorriefoundation.org, and look at a press release that talks about really some horrific things that came out in trial that we didn't know about until yesterday.
And finally, what are you going to do tomorrow on the 7th anniversary of the killing of your daughter, Rachel Corrie? What are you going to do?
Well, we're doing some wonderful things. So we're going to go to Ramallah, where the city of Ramallah is going to name a street after Rachel. And I'm told that there'll be quite a number of diplomats and people there, but that'll be interesting. And we just heard a little bit about that there's a group of school children close to Tel Karam that wanted us to come to visit them, and we can't do that tomorrow, but they're going to come down for that street naming. So there's going to be some school children there, and then later on, that'll be around a little afternoon, and then later on in the evening, we're coming back here to Haifa. We're going to see, this will be the second time in Haifa we've seen the play, My Name is Rachel Corrie, in Arabic, done by wonderful Israeli-Palestinian actress. And so we're going to see the play. My name is Rachel Corey, and there's going to be some things down here in Haifa, too. So we'll be able to do that. We're trying to be in at least video contact. I don't think it'll be live, but send messages to some people around the world, in particular at the Rachel Corey Youth and Cultural Center in Rafa and our friends there. So we try to be tied with a number of people, and we're in a good place in the world to do that right now.
All right. Well, you have been listening to an interview with Craig Corey. He and the family and the Foundation for Rachel Corey are suing the state of Israel. This is in a civil court now for the unlawful killing in Rafah on March 16th, 2003, unlawful killing of their daughter, the extraordinary Rachel Corey. We are honored to keep track. We've been in this with you from the beginning, and you know that we
spoke
with Rachel Corey before, a week before this, and was supposed to have her on a couple of days after this, so it's sort of, this is the journalistic side of it, and it's always, I'm always, always nervous now when I postpone an interview.
Yeah, you don't put this on your day timer, you know, the killing of your daughter. It's changed our lives, and we appreciate the fact that we've had support from you and Nora, particularly throughout all this time. And you're just two of the new friends that we found through Rachel, and that's a great. It's part of the healing process. It means a lot to us and the listeners too.
Again, Craig Corey, we wish you the best. Tomorrow, 7th anniversary, we'll be thinking about you.
Thank you.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, there have been elections in Iraq, trying to understand, sort out what's going on, what the significance is, and what the current situation on the ground is. And one of the people who always comes back to help us do that is Riad Jarrar. Riad Jarrar is an Iraqi-born political analyst who just a couple of weeks ago came back from his country of Iraq. He's a senior fellow with Peace Action in Washington, D.C., and has been writing a lot about the elections. We are glad to have you back with us to help us sort out what is going on. Well, there are sort of three main parties. And I guess, at least between Maliki and Alwi, it's fairly close.
Yeah, it's a very close election. Actually, there was one exit poll that was announced a few days ago that put the three leading coalitions very, very close to each other, with less than 2% difference between them. So it seems like it will take a few weeks until we figure out who came first, which coalition did collect the most votes in the election that took place last week.
Now, does it matter who won? What is the real significance of this election? Is this finally democracy in Iraq? How do you portray this?
Iraq is very far from having a democratic system. I mean, maybe one day in the future we will have a functional democracy. But for this election, it's too early to have an opinion. I mean, so far we're talking about, and according to the Iraqi law, we have to wait to see who gets the most number of seats And then that coalition will have the first chance to create a cabinet. So if the coalition fails to get half of the seats plus one, which is 163 seats in the parliament, the option goes to, or the possibility goes to the second option, to the second seat. So it's really complicated in this election because the highest number, the highest coalition, will get less than 25%. So there are many possibilities that other coalitions will try to cut some political deals and end up making it hard for whomever gets number one to reach to enough wide alliance to create the government. So it is really complicated. We have to wait for the next weeks, I think, to see what are the next major steps.
All right. I want to step back a little bit and ask you about your visit and about what you saw on the ground and what thoughts you had about what you saw. I mean, your country of Iraq has been through so much between the Iran-Iraq War, between the U.S. first Gulf War, Persian Gulf War, then the unbelievable sanctions that caused so much dying, and now we're hearing finally the U.S. At least it's the sense one gets when you watch policy is that there is some withdrawal going on of U.S. troops and some taking of the reins of power by the Iraqis. But what did you see on the ground? Where is your country now? Is there hope in the eyes and in the voices of the people that you met?
There is some hope because many Iraqis are starting to believe that the U.S. is actually leaving their country alone. You know, last year there was so much skepticism that the U.S. government will actually go ahead and implement the plan of withdrawing from Iraqi cities, and then after that implement the deadline of all troop withdrawal, which is supposed to take place next year. But this year I felt that there is more faith in the Obama administration's promises, and that is giving many Iraqis some hope. Now that said, the situation in Iraq is really miserable still. We're talking about a country that still does not have basic services. So when I was there, the electricity doesn't work all the time, and water doesn't work very well, and the sewage systems are still not functional. So, and the education and healthcare systems are in shambles. Many people, you know, prefer to leave the country to go to other countries' hospitals because the Iraqi hospitals are not working well. There are huge numbers of children who are not going to school. So even at like that level, Iraq is still a dysfunctional country with a dysfunctional government. Now, of course, what's even more dangerous from my point of view is that Iraq's political system and the Iraqi armed forces are still dysfunctional. The Iraqi armed forces are still infiltrated by militias and controlled by the current ruling parties. And all of these things are extremely deep, complicated problems for Iraq. Iraq is not a happy story, a democracy that we built and we have to celebrate now or anything. It's still a very sad story. It's a country where millions of people have been displaced and injured and killed in the last few years. And it's still a country that is struggling. But I think the first step towards ending this disaster, which is the U.S. withdrawal, I think the first step is on its way. And I think people have some hope that the situation will enhance because it seems like the U.S. is finally leaving.
How would you assess the refugee situation there? There is, I guess there's almost 2 million people outside the country, right?
Yeah, there are 4.5 million displaced Iraqis. Half of them are outside the country as refugees, as you mentioned, and the other half are internally displaced. Actually, I just met with the representative of Refugees International, who just came back from Iraq. She was there during the same time that I was there. And she was showing me pictures from her visit to Iraqi tent cities. You know, there are still inside Iraq, out of the 2.5 million displaced Iraqis inside the country, there are around 500,000 or 450,000 Iraqis who are still living in tents until this day. It's such a disaster. Had a million Iraqis who are internally displaced, not living in houses, living in tents and living in, you know, a miserable situation. It's heartbreaking. So overall, the displacement crisis is still there. It has not been dealt with because the reasons for the crisis are still there. You know, Iraqis were not displaced because of an earthquake or because of a natural disaster. They were displaced because of a foreign occupation that is still in their country, and that foreign occupation helped or brought the Iraqi government that is sectarian, that committed one of the largest ethnic and sectarian cleansing campaigns in the modern history of the region, and pushed these people outside their homes. Now, unfortunately, this government is still running the country, and these ruling parties are still influential. So the reasons for the displacement have not been solved, and I think when people think about the U.S. withdrawal, they're not only supported because it's important politically, but also because it's important for the humanitarian situation. Because once the U.S. ends its occupation and the Iraqis get to choose who runs their country by themselves, I think the displacement crisis will be on its way to be solved. But so far, the displacement crisis, it's still at its peak. The numbers of displaced Iraqis are still on the same high levels as they were last year or the year before.
We're speaking with Riad Jarar. He is an Iraqi-born political analyst. Went back to Iraq a couple of weeks ago. He is a senior fellow with Peace Action in Washington, D.C. I'd like you to take a few more minutes helping us understand when you use the phrase ethnic cleansing in the context of Iraq and U.S. policy. It gets somewhat confusing to people who haven't followed this closely, but please say a little bit more about that.
When Iraq was occupied in 2003, the Iraqi allies of the Bush administration who came to power came with an agenda to partition the country into sectarian and ethnic enclaves or confederations. So there were Sunni allies and Shiite allies and Kurdish allies to the Bush administration who ended up being the new rulers of Iraq. And when they came, whether they were Sunnis or Shiites or Kurds, they wanted to change Iraq's ruling system and Iraq's demographics as well to create these enclaves. So they started this ethnic and sectarian cleansing campaigns around the country with their militias, with even in many cases the militias were linked to the armed forces that were trained and supported by the U.S. So millions of non-Shiites were kicked out from the south, millions of non-Sunnis were kicked out from the middle and west, and hundreds of thousands of non-Kurds were kicked out from the north. And all of this to create a new demographic reality where partitioning Iraq is possible. Because in 2003, Iraq was so mixed and overlapped that they could not implement this idea. Now, unfortunately, the U.S. is a partner of in crime, whether it that indirectly because it trained and supported these militias, or in many cases directly because it helped build walls around the newly cleansed neighborhoods, that many Iraqis think that these walls played an important role in making the cleansing long-term or permanent rather than helping people go back to their original neighborhoods. So it's a very messy and complicated story. It will take hours to describe all of its chapters, but unfortunately, until now, we still live the consequences of this, you know, ethnic and sectarian cleansing that came, that happened under the U.S. occupation. You know, when I was in Iraq before 2003, we did not have such a thing as a Sunni neighborhood or a Shiite neighborhood. And Dennis, as you know, I am personally half Sunni and half Shiite. And we never had these, like, these issues in Iraq. Now we do. Now we have the new demographic realities, unfortunately, based on these ethnic and sectarian cleansing campaigns that took place in the last 7 years. And I think many Iraqis would like to work very hard to fix the damage that happened. They would like to work very hard to rebuild the Iraqi civil society that was mixed and overlapped. And now they are trying to do this. I mean, we saw the election was one step towards there because most of the sectarian parties fell and they failed and did not get votes. And most of the nationalist parties got most of the votes.
All right, we have a few minutes left, and there's one other topic I'd like to hit, a very serious topic, doesn't make headlines much anymore. We did a lot of reporting on this show. I personally did a lot of reporting about the impact of so much chemistry in the form of weaponry that was dropped, imported, sold to Iraq, Iran, that turned the region into a very dangerous place, particularly for children in their formative years. The impact of the chemistry has been overwhelming. Now, you talk about a failing medical system, and this with the overlay, this kind of weaponry and this leftover stuff from so many years of war that is really troubling on a whole other level. Is there anybody watching this, paying attention? What's the situation on this medical front, and are we still seeing a massive impact on children?
Unfortunately, yes. Actually, there were a few new reports on the effects of depleted uranium and other weapons that were used by the U.S. in cities like Fallujah or in other southern Iraqi cities. The U.S. started using depleted uranium in Iraq from 1991. In the first war, there was massive use of depleted uranium in areas around Basra and other cities in the south. I was talking to one of my friends a couple of days ago about this, about how the U.S. legacy and this occupation's legacy will be that the U.S. invaded the country and destroyed it and left tons of, you know, depleted uranium and other, you know, chemical weapons and other radioactive weapons. And unfortunately, when Iraqis look back at this occupation and on the 20 years of the U.S. intervention, they will not remember it with good, you know, romantic memories. The legacy will not be that the U.S. went to Iraq and helped Iraqis or freed them or brought them democracy. That is not the legacy. The legacy is that the U.S. will go down history as yet another invader who attacked Iraq and destroyed the country and brought death and weapons and, you know, radioactive materials that will poison Iraqis for the next hundreds of years. So, I mean, there is a lot of work to be done to fix this. And I think there are a couple of Iraqi organizations who I heard of who are trying to start national campaigns to clean Iraq from depleted uranium bullets and depleted uranium missiles and the remains of white phosphorus and the other poisons that were dropped on Iraq's soil and are swimming now in the Iraqi table water and underground water and rivers. People want to work and clean their country and clean their environment. And this is one of the disasters, one of the many disasters that must be fixed after the U.S. occupation ends.
We have about 2 minutes left. Are you concerned that the expanding war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, will impact negatively again on Iraq?
Not necessarily. I am very concerned that the U.S. foreign policy continues to be the same. And now we hear the same lame excuses to justify more interventions and to justify more killing and more invasions and more occupations. Iraq was a disaster, not because it was a war that went wrong or an occupation that went wrong, but because it was yet another war. It's a symptom of the U.S. foreign policy that needs to be changed. It's a symptom of the problem. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like the Washington, D.C. decision makers or the military-industrial complex are taking any of these lessons in consideration. I don't think that there is a direct negative impact from the wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan on what's happening in Iraq. It seems like it is actually creating enough pressure on the Obama administration and Pentagon to fulfill their promises and end the occupation in Iraq in accordance to the binding bilateral agreement that was signed with the Iraqi government, because it doesn't seem like they can handle both wars at the same time.
Right, saved by the Iraqis are saved by another war. And we're out of time right there. Ryan Gerard, there's hope somewhere in this world. I want to thank you. I want to let people know that you are a senior fellow with Peace Action in Washington, D.C., just back a couple of weeks ago from your home country of Iraq. And people can very quickly check your website out at what would that be?
You can either check my blog. It's In the Middle. If you Google my name or write In the Middle, it comes up. Or Peace Action's website. It's peace-action.org.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.